You're listening to the Master Passive Income Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Breakthrough Investor Show. My name is Charles Rose Jr., and we focus on breaking through limitations and barriers to get you to that next level of investing. With me is William Palmer, my amazing co-host. And in today's episode, our guest will be talking about how he went from an officer in the Army to being a non-traditional short-term rental expert.
That's right, Charles. He'll also highlight some of the struggles he went through to be a breakthrough investor and his thoughts on the future of Airbnb. Let's get started.
Welcome to the Breakthrough Investor Show, where we guide you to financial freedom and break barriers in your investing to give you the secrets to success. And now, here are your hosts, Charles Rose Jr. and William Palmer.
Today's guest is a really good friend, too. I met him at RubeCon 2 years back-to-back. So the first year at RubeCon, so he was actually, his room was actually right across from mine.
Right, we met when we first arrived.
right across it. So, and yeah, it was funny. It was like, yeah, don't worry. I didn't hear anything because my wife was with me. But great guy, very funny, and just, you know, such a giving heart. And so, you know, more about our guest today. He served 11 years on active duty in the U.S. military. He is a rental property expert with a focus on non-traditional short-term rentals. And within 2 years of getting started in short-term rentals, he and his lovely wife created enough cash flow to cover their entire cost of living. I think you guys want to really, really listen to the strategies. He knows what he's doing. And, you know, he continues to buy all of these high cash flowing properties and absolutely loves teaching others how to do it and watching their lives change. So he is also very passionate about helping people and he's so passionate that he actually has his own podcast. And that podcast is called Living Off Rentals. And he helps his audience, giving them tools and systems to generate income through property ownership. And the whole intent is to help them replace that 9-to-5 income and provide the ability to live off rentals, just like he does with his family. So help me today welcome our guest, Kirby Atwill. What's up, buddy? How you doing, man?
Charles, William, it's great to be here. I'm really excited to be on your podcast. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, man. And so, man, this is so good. Like, you know, the stuff you teach. And I always tell people, I said, if you want to do short-term rentals, you need to do it like Kirby. He does it the smart way. And so literally, I tell people that all the time, man. So I'm a huge fan of what you do and how you do your business. But before we, you know, jump into some more of that, Kirby, tell us more about you, more about your investing journey and what initially made you want to do it.
Yeah. I'll give a sort of a short summary here. So I kind of grew up with the rich dad, poor dad influences in my house. You know, my dad worked for the city. He worked for the Park District. So it was a very secure city job, 9-to-5 with a pension. And then my mom owned her own insurance brokerage. So got to see the entrepreneurial side of things where she kind of set her own hours. And it was eat what you kill. And she started with nothing, you know, no clients, and really built her business up. And I was always drawn toward that side of things, the entrepreneurial side of things. But I knew I also wanted to serve in the military. So ended up going to West Point and then served as an officer in the Army after that. And I got out in 2011. But while I was in the Army, I picked up what I call the gateway drug into real estate investing, which is Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and read that book and got hooked just like so many other people do on the concept. And started buying a few rentals while I was in the Army, and then got out and I started flipping. In 2011, I started flipping full time with a couple partners, and realized that that was going to be a treadmill that I was never going to get off of. We made a lot of money and spent all of it pretty much trying to continue to build the business, and there was never anything left over, no residual income coming in. And so I'm a slow learner, and it took me 5 years to realize that this was kind of a dead end street. So that's when I transitioned to long-term rentals initially. And then in 2017 landed on this short-term rental strategy that we've been doing ever since that has been an absolute life changer really for us. So happy to share about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. We want to hear your strategy. I can hear it over and over and I won't get tired of listening to it because I feel like I always learn something new. Every time I hear you talk about it, I'm like, man, I miss that. You know, share more about that strategy. I think our listeners are eagerly waiting to hear about it. And also talk about, you know, why you choose that strategy too. So really deep dive into that.
So that's
that's sort of like the backup plan. I have a very specific criteria for purchasing. I call it the 1% net rule. I came up with it based on, everyone's kind of heard of the 1% rule that, mm-hmm. you know, people talk about in Bigger Pockets a lot, where if you buy a long-term rental, it should make 1% gross of the purchase price on a monthly basis. So buy a $100,000 property, it needs to rent for $1,000 a month to be considered a good property. I have the 1% net rule when I purchase. So if I'm buying a $100,000 property, after all my expenses, after I paid the cleaner, after my set aside for maintenance, after my mortgage, my taxes, everything, it needs to make $1,000 a month of net income. Because at the end of the day, if you're interested in financial freedom, you should never talk about gross numbers ever again the rest of your whole life, because I cannot pay my grocery bill with a gross number. I don't care if it brings in $1 million a month. If it costs me $1 million a month, I am no closer to financial freedom. And if you just take away that one concept, you're going to be so much better off and so much closer to financial freedom, because everyone loves to talk about their seven-figure business and how much they're bringing in and all that. Show me the bottom line that you can pay your mortgage with, and that's your financial freedom number. Yeah, exactly. So I buy based off the 1% net rule, and then it always has to meet the criteria of being a good, you know, cash, at least cash flowing as a long-term rental, as a backup plan, so that if I have a whole portfolio of these and overnight I have to switch them to long-term rentals, they still cash flow. I'm not negative cash flow on every single property or anything like that.
Fantastic. That's such a great strategy, man. And so how did you decide that, you know, hey, this is going to be the strategy I'm going to do? Like, talk about that process. Because on this podcast, we want to kind of touch, you know, on the mindset to what people need to do to be a breakthrough investor, to break through that next level. So what was that process like to you, you know, kind of switching from the traditional way everybody does things? How did you come up with this method?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I wish I could say I just had this like vision and it was like this, you know, I just figured it out because of, I could just see it happening. I kind of fell into it. So we built up a portfolio of 24 long-term rentals fairly quickly after I transitioned from flipping. And it was okay. You know, each one was making several hundred dollars a month of cash flow. But we needed a lot of them to get to financial freedom. And at the same time, we were kind of envisioning what financial freedom meant to us. And I think that's so important too, is defining what that is, so you can have a place to backwards plan from. And so at the time we moved, as we were building this portfolio, we moved to Northwest Indiana where we live now, bought this old house that was all like green shag carpets, wood paneling. Like it was like, you know, 1970s original, but it had this walkout basement. And it was unfinished. And so we were like, you know, should we finish the basement? Or I keep hearing about this Airbnb thing. Maybe we should just, you know, turn the basement into a separate apartment and try it. And worst case scenario, we're adding a bunch of equity to the property and we can use it as a long-term rental. So that's what we did. And we finished right before Memorial Day. This is back in 2017. And we put it on Airbnb and it booked out for the whole summer. And we ended up making over $20,000 just in that summer. And I had long-term rentals that I didn't make $20,000 in the whole year on.
Gross or net?
Yeah. That's net? Gross. Yeah, that's
okay.
Gross.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I know. I should talk about net numbers. But net numbers actually were, you know, it wasn't any income we were expecting. So it was pretty much. My wife was cleaning it between stays because we didn't have cleaners at the time. Like, we did everything. You know, we just kind of figured it out as we went. So it really was just all extra income for us. And so after that experience, I was like, there's something to this. And if we can scale this, it makes sense. So we bought the next one, then was close by in Indiana. And we bought a 3-1 that was just the ideal long-term rental. that I knew would work fantastic as a long-term rental. Kind of did the Burr model, got it for $40,000, $39,000. And you know, fixed it up and then we put it on Airbnb and the same thing happened. I was just kind of basing it off of other comps in the area. I was like, I think it's going to do a lot better as a short-term rental, but it'll work as a long-term rental if I have to. And it just did great. And so what we realized then, as we started to buy more of them, is that if we could buy multi-units, the cash flow was like significantly higher, which wasn't intuitive to us because, you know, we knew per unit, the nightly rate and the occupancy rate was probably going to be a little bit lower because you're sharing walls with people. And you can't, you know, command as much because it's attached, but yet you have one set of fixed, relatively low expenses that were on par with a single family home. So you still have the same expenses, but you've got, you know, almost twice the income or almost three times the income. So your net cash flow was off the charts. And so that's how we started buying these 1% net deals. And some of them are 2%, 3% net deals, which is just, it's hard to comprehend, but when you're buying them that efficiently or that low of a cost and the taxes are pretty low, you know, all your other expenses are relatively low, but you're bringing in multiple streams of income. The cash flow really adds up.
Mm-hmm. I bet. Yeah,
man, that's so cool, man. And so it seems like these type of properties can produce a lot more net cash flow, right? So if someone has like an average income, not average income, not average expenses, let's just say $5,000 a month, how many of these properties would someone need to like be financially free?
Yeah, it's, you know, it really, like, I don't like to say this because I don't want to like make it sound like, oh, it's just easy to go out and buy one. But literally, you could get there with one of these properties if you were to buy a four unit property. There's people that I work with. There's a guy who actually just found one in the Upper Peninsula, which I never would have expected. Upper Peninsula, Michigan, to be like a place where it works, but it's right on Lake Superior in a decent town. It's not like a huge town, but it's a decent sized town. And is just getting it so inexpensive, but there's four units. And so even at $100 a night on average across the year, and I think it was a 63% occupancy rate, it was still several thousands of dollars per month of net cash flow. Wow. So
that's management. Awesome.
What about management for places that are, let's say I wanted to go to Georgia, Alabama, something like that. Mm-hmm. How do you find vet managers and things like that, and cleaning ladies, whatever needs to happen, people that go stock everything? How do you go about that?
Yeah. Initially, I thought we needed to do that all ourselves. And so that's why we started buying here. And I was kind of my own worst enemy for a year. I would go restock all the supply closets. If a guest couldn't figure out the door code, which was always Friday night when they're trying to check in, I would ruin my Friday night and drive over there and get them, you know, in or fix their Wi-Fi issues. Then I realized this is crazy. I can have team members who are assigned these roles and they, that's their role, and it doesn't cost that much. So now we have a really good handyman and cleaner, and now we have nine different cleaners in place that, you know, that can rotate between the different properties, because in the summertime, especially, there's a lot of turnover. Then we got a couple handy people, I guess. But with those two people, every single boots on the ground activity can be assigned to them. And a lot of people will say, well, what about the 2 a.m. plumbing emergency? It's not an emergency. Like, you know that a 2 a.m. plumbing thing is going to come up at some point. So assign that to somebody. That's somebody's job. And as long as we're all in agreement that that is somebody's role and somebody's covering anything that could possibly come up in addition to all the things that regularly happen, like cleanings and touch-ups and stuff, then it's taken care of. So those two key individuals are who we have. We also have like emergency plumbing services that are 24 hours or emergency HVAC that we could call if needed, but it's very rare that we get those individuals.
That's awesome, man.
It sounds like
go ahead, buddy.
It sounds like you're super huge on the networking bit, which is one of my huge things. I love networking. If I could get paid to network, which I guess is kind of what we're doing right now.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
If I could get paid to network, I would be like a pig in mud. It's awesome. But have you found that the networking has been one of the biggest keys to your success? It sounds like it probably is one of the top ones, if not the best.
It is. It absolutely, like, that's, I think you're, I heard someone say relationships equal revenue. I mean, that absolutely, like, so many opportunities come from just sharing what you're doing. I've found that, you know, I'm more of an introvert myself. Like, I, you know, I'm happy to work in my barn office all day long and kind of just put my head down. And, you know, I get energy that way. Like, but, you know, at the same time, I realize the importance of relationships. So I've tried to reconcile that in my head over the years. And what I've realized is that if I do a lot more pull marketing, it leads to very beneficial relationships. So I try to put out a lot of content because I enjoy doing that. I don't enjoy going to a room full of people and shaking hands every night. Like, that's not the networking that, you know, that drains me of energy. So by putting out a lot of content, it's brought a lot of people into my sphere that wouldn't have been otherwise. So it's just been a much more effective way for me to kind of pick and choose who's in my network then, and bring in opportunities as opposed to like seeking out opportunities, and being more on the offense, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Man, that's super cool, man. And to kind of piggyback off of networking. So I hear you say often, you know, we're building a duplex in Florida. So who is we? Is this you and your wife, or do y'all have is it like a joint partnership? How does that work with your business?
Yeah, good question. I mean, depending on the property, there's different setups. So some of them I just own myself through a basically single member LLC. Some of them I own as a partnership where it's a LLC that I own with either friends or family. So my family kind of has done quite a few of them in terms of like, we just pooled resources together. We buy them. And then there's a split of ownership. And then on top of that, there's compensation for the work that I'm doing. So, so for example, there's a LLC that I own with my two brothers and my parents, and we split it five ways based on the amount of capital we each contributed. But then I get paid a finder's fee for the deal that I find, and it's based on, I'm trying to remember actually what the finder's fee is based on now. It's based on I think it's a percentage of the purchase price is what we decided on that. Cause we're trying to make it the interests all aligned. So there's three ways I get compensated for my work. So finder's fee to find the deal. Then when we're rehabbing it, I get compensated, a percentage of the rehab budget. Mm-hmm. So based on how big the rehab is basically how I'm getting compensated. And then the last way is a compensation of the difference between what it appraises for and how much we have in it. So there's a percentage of that I get paid. So I'm very incentivized to try to keep the cost down as much as possible, build as much equity. Everybody makes money if that happens, and I get paid a percentage of the equity that I create. So by doing, and then there's a management fee too. I'm sorry. There's a management fee as well. On a monthly basis to manage the property going forward. So, you know, I need to buy properties that make a lot of sense to make all those numbers work, but it works really well with the BRRRR model, which is typically what we tend to do is find beat up properties, rehab them, and then turn them into these utilitarian Airbnbs.
Man, that is so awesome. Like I mentioned, like I just learned something new every time you share this story. And because I'd like to do that next. I mean, I started my portfolio mostly long-term rentals, but now I'm in the process of, you know, midterm and short-term rentals. And so, yeah, this is such like good strategies that not only we could use, but our listeners who's listening right now, I'm sure they're going to be interested in doing this. But, you know, during your journey, Kirby, I'm sure there were some challenges along the way. Would you mind sharing some challenges that you've had along the way? And how did you get through those challenges? And what did you learn from them?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot. So trying to boil it down to maybe some of the best lessons that I've had. So a big one was early on. So when I was flipping, and I think this also applies to people who are maybe working a corporate job, everyone tends to be focused on net worth a lot more than cash flow. I'd say probably, you know, 90% of people out there, I don't know that I'm making up that figure, but the vast majority of people out there, all their investments are based on the thought process that if I invest in a 401k or I invest in a mutual fund or a stock or crypto or anything like that, down the road, hopefully it's worth a whole bunch more. And I think a lot of people start their career with the thought process of, you know, they want to get to financial freedom. And if I just save enough, eventually somewhere along my path, way before I get to 65, I'm going to have enough accumulated that I can, you know, get out of the rat race early. But what typically happens if all your investments are focused on just value later on, I talk to people all the time who are making incredible salaries. They've saved up literally millions of dollars and they're petrified. Like they're like, oh, if I get fired tomorrow, I got to start living off the principal, you know? And so there's never a number that's going to be enough for you to get to freedom if you're just focused on accumulation and your net worth. It sounds sexy to talk about your net worth, but literally your net worth is totally worthless when it comes to financial freedom. Like the only thing, in my opinion, that matters is cash flow. Like I said, net cash flow. So I wish I could go back, tell myself this in the beginning, spend every single free dollar that I have on creating as much cash flow as possible. Because if you can buy, like, for example, the properties we're talking about, if they create $2,000 of net cash flow per property per month, you know, you don't need a whole lot of those to get to financial freedom. So if you put every dollar toward that in the beginning, it takes you maybe a couple years, and then you've got income enough to support you for the rest of your life. And if your net worth was zero, and it stayed at zero for the rest of your life, which obviously you're going to pay off the mortgage as over time, but let's just say it stayed at zero, you're financially free the rest of your life. You just freed up probably hundreds of thousands of hours of working time because of cash flow, not because you just accumulated $1 million net worth or $2 million net worth. And then, you know, if after you get to that point, you want to accumulate net worth, well, you've got all this time, you know, you can accumulate as much net worth as you want, but I think cash flow first is so important. Mm-hmm. So flipping, you know, it's all about what you can sell the property for and get paid. And so it's all about like the short-term increases in your net worth, not cash flow. It's going to perpetually pay you. And that's a lot of corporate jobs as well. So if I could go back, I'd say that's probably the biggest mistake I made. I wish I would have just kept what I was buying back in 2011, 12, 13. And I'd be in a much different place in terms of my net worth today and cash flow.
Mm, yeah, that's so good. Net cash flow first, network second, right? So what's the biggest advice you would give to someone, you know, who's trying to be a breakthrough investor? You know, we consider a breakthrough investor someone who's breaking to that next level of investing, whether it's breaking through mindsets, barriers, or whatever it is that's stopping you from getting to that next level. Mm-hmm. So what would be your biggest piece of advice to that person?
I'd say, you know, I'm big on goals. I'm big on setting goals, but I look at goals very differently now. I don't look at goals as a destination. I think that's what people tend to say. I want to have this car. I want to have, you know, $1 million or whatever it is that thing is, six pack abs, you know, then what, you know, once you get to that goal, what does the next day look like for you? And if you ask them that question, it's like, well, I don't know, then that, you know, like I accomplished that thing. You know, I ran the race and now the race is over. And you hear about people like athletes, you know, they accomplish this goal and then they're miserable the next day. So that's, to me, that's an indicator that that's not a winning formula. So to me, the goal is actually a state of being, really. So I really encourage people to think about, what do you want your days to actually look like? When you're goal setting, like, figure out, in a perfect scenario, this is what my days would look like. And that's what we did. And that's kind of like what changed for us. And really, it was a huge game changer, like, because we realized it actually doesn't cost us nearly as much as we thought. Like, we had these fantasy numbers in our head that we need to get to this certain place. Actually, we didn't need to get to that place. It was a lot cheaper than we thought. And then we had a place to backwards plan, and it's a process. So really, like, all you're trying to do on a daily basis is create more of your ideal life and less of the things you don't want. So if you're have the goal of living a life a certain way, but you're in a corporate job that will never provide you enough freedom or enough income to support that ideal lifestyle, you're going to feel very stuck. But if you've identified your ideal lifestyle, now you can say, okay, I know this will never get me there. So now I can start putting in place the things or the state of being that I need to have to get to that place. So I'm working a corporate job, but I need to be a real estate investor to have the freedom, to have the cash flow, to support this ideal lifestyle. So you can start to transition to the type of person that you need to be to live the lifestyle that you've identified in your mind as the ideal lifestyle. So I think that's probably the best piece of advice I would give. It's hard to do, to envision what your ideal lifestyle is, but the more crystal clear you can get on that, I think the better off you're going to be in the long run.
Dude, that's awesome, man. We should maybe have you do a workshop on that at the next Real Estate Wealth Builders Conference. Because that's so key to benefit from. I know for me, setting goals has been big, you know, in my life, and not just, like you say, not just any regular goals that you get unmotivated about, but, you know, these clear goals that defines who you are, right? Yes. And so I agree with you 100% on that, man. And but you know what I love about you, Kirby, is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, like, you have such a giving heart and you help so many people, and you share a lot of these strategies and interview a lot of people to help your audience on your podcast, Living Off Rentals. And so what inspired you to start that podcast?
Kind of like you said, like, I've always wanted to, when my wife and I were kind of coming up with our goals and what we wanted our ideal lifestyle to look like, we defined what we wanted our days to look like, how we wanted to spend time with our kids. We have three little kids down the road when we didn't even have kids. And a lot of it, like, to get to that place, we knew we needed to get to a place of financial freedom. And so that was part of the goals. But then once we got to financial freedom, then you ask, well, then what? Like, is the point of life to get to a place where you don't have to do anything again the rest of your life and you could just sit around? Like, I don't think that's the point of life. But what is the point of life after that place then, when you have the autonomy and the ability to make decisions? I think then it's impact, you know, like, it's helping other people, really. Like, and so you can do that a lot, I think, a lot more on a bigger scale if you get to a place of financial freedom, because, you know, a lot of constraints are removed. And so that's really the impetus for us. Like, we started envisioning what our life would look like once we got there. And I wanted to have an impact on other people. I wanted to share some of the things I had, you know, learned along the way and some of my experiences. And so I figured a podcast was a great way to just start doing that without any commitment. You know, like, I committed to doing it once a week, but there was no permission that I needed to get granted. There was no big overhead costs. The only thing that was holding me back from starting that was me, you know? So it's one of those things that you can easily do. And I think a lot of people don't do because they think, well, why, what is this person going to think of me if, you know, I don't have a big listener base or I've never done this before or whatever. So once you get beyond that, then you can start impacting people. And so initially it was my mom who was my only listener. And then that turned into my mom and my best friend. And then over time, after several episodes, it started growing from there. But you have to be comfortable with that being, you know, a starting place, and then in that it will grow over time. And so it has. And then that turned into a YouTube channel, and it turned into this program that I started that I walk people through the process of starting or buying their first high cash flowing rental property, and in a ton of opportunities. I got to interview Robert Kiyosaki on the podcast, which was awesome. Yeah. I mean, he's a guy that kind of started me along the journey, you know, back with Rich Dad, Poor Dad. So he never would have agreed to like just sit down with me for an hour and chat. But since I had a podcast and we kind of had a shared background, he was willing to come on. So stuff like that, it's been awesome. So long way to answer your question.
Funny story about that. I actually invited Robert Kiyosaki to RubeCon this last one. Mm. I tried to find like the closest email that might get to him. And I sent an invite. I was like, I'll pay for your ticket. You just come. Didn't get anything back. So Robert, if you're listening to this, you come to the next one, I'll get you in.
Nice. Yeah.
You know, William, you know, since we have Curry on here, maybe Robert may listen, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I got your ticket.
He's a huge supporter of the military, so he may end up doing that.
Oh man, that would be awesome. Yeah. That would be absolutely awesome. We got to try to make that work, William. So we got to come up with a game plan to make that happen, man. So Kirby, you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, oh, the short-term rental market is gonna crash. It's gonna be some point where it's oversaturated. You know, I've been hearing a lot of things like that, and I know you have a great backup plan already for your properties, but isn't it just, you know, I think it's even more amazing if it stays, because then you make even more profit than the long-term rentals. So based on your experience, where do you see the future of short-term rentals? Where are the opportunities and how can investors prepare for them?
Yeah. Again, I mean, going back to the definition of short-term rentals, like it's such a broad broad category that, you know, people will cite instances of like, you know, Joshua Tree is way oversaturated now, so short-term rentals don't work anymore. And it's like, well, that's, you know, that's one tiny little sector of short-term rentals. Or, you know, there's certainly examples where after COVID, all of a sudden the numbers were incredible because people were traveling so much more or wanting to get out of, you know, the city or whatever. And so numbers just shot through the roof, and that increased competitiveness, especially in the mainstream markets where everyone was buying. So I think people who are holding million-dollar properties that would never work as a long-term rental, and the competition is immense in those markets, and everyone's vying for the same guests. That's a scary place to be in. I don't know what the good outcome is going to be there, because it can only appreciate so much, and there's only so many people that are going to travel, and there's more and more people, you know, getting into that space. But in these utilitarian markets, like we have a few hundred in our market, and there's nowhere near enough short-term rentals for the amount of people that want to travel to that market, especially in the high season. You know, that's when we make the all our profit, but the rest of the year we're at least breaking even. But it evens out to be a high amount of cash flow annually. So I think there's a ton of room in those markets to, you know, the numbers might taper off a bit, you know, as some of the numbers are kind of unbelievable in terms of how high they are. So I think more and more people will get into it. But I think it's got a long way to go before it gets to where it's on par with long-term rental cash flow. And if it was, then there wouldn't be a reason to do it, because it is more time intensive. But I think there's a long way to go with it. And so I'm just enjoying the process while we can, and have a great backup plan in place.
Hmm. Yeah, that's awesome, man. And I love your explanation, but I think the short answer is follow Kirby's method.
Yeah, I'm surprised more people don't do that with short-term rentals. It's immediately they go to the lakefront property that's super expensive. But
yeah, well, I don't know about you, Charles. You may have also, but I had several people try to sell me properties as short-term rentals this year alone, and I had a guy offer me a $900,000 portfolio, three different properties, worked phenomenally well as midterm rentals, three of the properties, but they were terrible as long-term. And I turned it down because I could not foresee if like short-term takes a tank, I'm in the hole immediately. Yeah. And then I got to get rid of these properties and I won't be able to sell them for what they're valued at, even though they had $1 million valuation for everything. Yeah. It just didn't work out. And I'm starting to think that that was the right move.
There's a lot of short-term rentals for sale right now. Mm-hmm. And people have great projections on all of them, but we'll see how it plays out. Hmm.
Yeah, that's crazy. I see even some syndicators are doing short-term rentals to make the, you know, to try to make the projections work, but some of them may work, but I'd be pretty afraid of that. Like I probably wouldn't invest in that syndication unless they have the Kirby method
going on. The backup plan. Yeah.
That's exactly right, man. But this being completely fantastic, Kirby, man. I think, you know, more than likely we might have missed something along the way. Is there anything we missed so our audience can become a breakthrough investor just like you?
I don't think so. I think we've talked about all the main things that I wanted to share. There's a great book that I recommend to all the people I work with and you know, my community, and it's called Effortless. It's by the same writer as what was his first book? Now I'm drawing a blank on it, and I've read it like five times. Essentialism. So Greg McKeown is the author. So he wrote Effortless as his second book, but it talks about the difference between linear results and residual results, which not a lot of people talk about. But linear results are you do work today and you get paid for it today, and then it's done. You know, that's a flip. That's linear results. It's a one and done type thing. Residual results are you do work today and you get paid the rest of your life. That can be a rental property, it can be a relationship, it can take so many different forms. You can create content that people enjoy over and over again. There can be so many different ways to get residual results. So I think the last piece of advice I would say is, as you're thinking through your goals and structuring the work that you're going to do, think in terms of, is this residual work or is this linear work? And how can I transition it to be more residual so that it keeps paying me in a perpetuity.
That's awesome, Kirby. Thank you so much for sharing that, man. This has been amazing, man. People are going to want to find you and listen to you online, Kirby. How can they find you and how can they connect with you?
Yeah, I'd say the best way probably is at livingoffrentals.com. There's a link. You can click on start right at the top, and that will take you to sort of an overview of my whole process of how I work. So it's a masterclass I recorded that'll walk you through step by step how I find deals, how I finance them, like, you know, my methodology. And so I think that's probably the best place to start. And then there's the podcast and YouTube channel and lots of content there as well.
Awesome, man. Fantastic. Awesome. Well, Kirby, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. It's so great to have you as one of our first guests. So thank you so much. And you have a blessed day, brother.